had to put it back together from bits I found floating around Endor.
It's got very strong offensive capabilities, though.
Sorry, Yavin. First one was Yavin 4.
Oh,
sorry.
You're right. It was. Embarrassing. Live from the Mundangerous Start Finish Line in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 189 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're waving the green flag on our plan to discuss racing. But first, the Rogue Trader's investigation blows up in their face in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign. And later, the Marathoner can make the trip without dying in the Character Creation Forge. Doesn't that make the Marathoner not a real original Marathoner?
Technically true, but so. Slightly more reusable character, if you will.
The one-hit wonder.
Mm-hmm.
So, Shane, we got a bit of new Eberron news recently.
Uh-huh.
The Artificer Revisited is out. Do you remember Wizards of the Coast put out an Unearthed Arcana where they took the first stab at the Artificer a while back?
I do.
Remember that it was not very good?
Yeah, that was like 2.5 years ago.
Yeah, it was a while ago, and I think we spent a long time ripping it apart on the air.
Mm-hmm. Are we going to do that again?
No, for two reasons. One, let's not spend that long, because 6 months from now, it won't be worthwhile to listen to again.
Mm-hmm.
And two, this one's much, much better.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, right? Keith Baker even said it's much, much better.
Well, I'll defer to Keith in all things Eberron quality related.
Yeah, or not Eberron quality, I guess. I saw that man eat a cookie for lunch, and I went, brilliant. So the first thing that popped out of me is that, in the first iteration, one of the subclasses was the gunsmith. They just used the thunder cannon, and they just sort of pew-pewed at everything. That's gone. No guns in this one, although there is a little sidebar that says, hey, if your game has guns, then, artificers should have proficiency in them. But, canonically, Eberron doesn't have guns. You have wands.
Mm-hmm. That actually doesn't stop us from having turrets, though.
No, not at all. We definitely do have arcane turrets, which I think are pretty awesome, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's still, D8 hit points. You get some cool little flavorful abilities where you can, make things glow or sounds or whatever. But the main points are that it's a half caster. So you get up to 5th level spells, same as the Paladin and the Ranger. You get some cantrips, which is nice, unlike the Paladin and the Ranger. Also, it's a strange spell progression. You get your first spell at 1st level, not at 2nd level. So you start with spells, which is great. And baseline spells are pretty utility-focused, which at first seems disappointing when you look at the Artificer spell list, because it's where's my Blast the Artificer? How do you, cause terrible destruction in the last war if you can't cast a fireball?
Mm-hmm.
But don't you worry. Because there are two subclasses. The first one is the Alchemist, which is sort of your traditional potion mixer gadget tweaker, which gets a little pet homunculus that can basically give out bardic inspiration and heal people. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Artillerist, which, like you said, makes a big freaking mobile turret that shoots fire. Also, you get to add spells like Shield and Scorching Ray and Fireball to your spell list.
Right, the Artillerist gets it as their sort of specialty spells at each level that don't count as prepared.
I do like that there are a host of abilities that the baseline Artificer gets that make you feel like that magical tinkerer who's doing things on the fly, on the battlefield, or, think of Iron Man who ducks behind a pillar for, 8 seconds while he somehow pulls out a Phillips head screwdriver, tweaks something in his gauntlet, and then now has a new ability.
Mm-hmm.
That's very much what artificers have always been like.
Yeah.
But you get abilities that help you do that. You get expertise in all tools that you're proficient with. And you have the ability, unlike any other class in the game, to swap out your cantrips on a short or long rest, which is really nice. And then you get infusions, which are what artificer spells used to be known as. At higher levels, you can stick spells in items and then hand them off to other people. So you can eventually become the party armorer.
One of the things that stands out here is there's actually real new mechanics involved in this class, right? It isn't just recycling mechanics that we've seen elsewhere. They've actually sat and built something new which feels like a move in the right direction. And I think that's why, like, one of the underlying reasons we didn't feel so great about the original Artificer.
Yeah, right. Like, the gunsmith was just, like, someone who may as well be using Eldritch Blast.
Right.
Yeah, but, yeah, this one I like a lot more. I mean, there are some wording issues that are a little unclear, but that makes sense. This is still very much a work in progress. I think it's a really good step in the right direction.
I also like that it gets Constitution as a saving throw. So now all of its concentration spells might actually stay up.
All right. Speaking of maybe being better the second time around, Shane, where are we in the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign?
So the Dynasty Unwarranted campaign is our Warhammer 40K Rogue Trader game, played using Dark Heresy 2nd Edition rules by Fantasy Flight Games. And on the Deathworld Iblis Prime, in the frontier city of Meridian, the Rogue Traders have set out to establish a colony in the name of the Holy Throne of Terra and Prophet. And with their mining operation likely sabotaged, for the very first time, the Rogue Trader herself, Lord Captain Silva Lionheart, makes her debut planetside.
Yes, for the very first time, the fake Rogue Trader herself makes her debut.
Right, she has left the ship.
Which basically means Susie showed up to the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for a long time, Susie, one of our players, was unable to attend sessions, like, in this arc, like, in this game, really, because of her work schedule. And so I had kind of allowed her to play the Silva Lionheart character remotely by sort of giving input here and there where it was necessary. But generally, you guys kind of played around her.
Or she would send down a directive, but we wouldn't see her.
Right.
Yeah.
And so instead, this is the first time that she actually built a character with a character sheet and showed up to a session. And from here on out, she was a regular attendee. So Silva Lionheart makes her debut on screen in somewhere in season 3.
Which is great, except for all those challenges that she brings along with her.
Yeah, she's got some news. The Watchtower, the sort of orbital defense platform above the planet, is reporting that there are warp wakes incoming, and they're mobilizing all ships in the system to a defensive posture in order to be prepared to meet it.
So she dispatches both Flare and Echo back to the ship to study those patterns, and they determine that those incoming vessels are likely going to be crewed ships, who are a mercenary Xenos species that are kind of avian and kind of reptilian. They're also known as good traders, though, so hey, maybe there's that.
Yeah, they're pretty famous amongst rogue trading circles as, you know, potential merchant traders and weird xenotech and,
yeah,
you know,
they have
fun
cool
stuff.
Weapons. Also, they eat people.
They definitely eat people, and they absorb their genetic material to continue evolving themselves. But that's, like, not that big of a deal.
Yeah, who are we to judge? Well, okay, never mind.
Well, you're the Imperium, so.
We're rogue traders. If they have the proper money, I think we can overlook a few things.
Right. So, meanwhile, down on the surface, Silva has now taken direct command of the investigation into the sabotage. And after you determine that the mine explosion was a time-delayed bomb, you start digging through worker records, and you find three of them are unaccounted for. And these are the three leads that you're going to pursue for further questioning.
My favorite part about this investigation scene was that Silva really did show up and take charge of the investigation, but she was in no way statted for investigating.
No. She was totally statted for management.
Yes. Which is exactly what it would have been like in 40K. I am now in charge, even though I'm completely unqualified except to be in charge.
Right. It's also, like, very much indicative of Susie's playstyle, which is, I'm not going to sit here while you drunkenly mumble for an hour. Let's get moving.
Yes. Also, I'm not going to spend an hour and a half building this character. I'm going to pick things that look cool.
Right.
Does that work? If they better work. All right. So Silva and her retinue visit the workers in Meridian and quickly rule out two of them. But the third one is dead in his hab block. Fortunately, they investigate the body. Unfortunately, the body is booby-trapped.
Yeah, I don't know how you didn't see this coming.
I did. I don't think I was there.
Oh, that's a good point. Well, I take it back. I don't see how Silva and Flair didn't see this coming.
Yeah, especially because we've seen this happen in other games. Dead bodies are always booby-trapped.
Mm-hmm.
They're not Schrodinger's dead bodies. They are always booby-trapped, even when they're not.
Right. So, yes, the booby trap is, of course, an explosive, which in turn levels the entire hab. And only through the grace of the Emperor do Silva and Flair survive this massive blast. There might have been some spent fate points.
Yeah, I think maybe Susie definitely had to. Angelo might have been able to use warp craziness and throw up a shield.
Yeah, but I think it was Susie's like first session in the game. Burn a fate point. Welcome to Rogue Trader.
Right. You're catching up with everybody else.
Right. I've got to get you down to one like everyone else, please. However, before the blast goes off, they are able to gather one lead. Flair was able to see the handiwork of the explosive device and recognize it as that of those old friends, the Technogangers.
Oh, wow. Maybe they're not quite as dumb as we thought. Well, we'll find out next week.
So this week, we are talking about running races.
Like elves and dwarves?
No.
And humans?
Not various races running. We're talking about a contest, a competition, in which the contestants are traveling some distance faster than the other competitors.
Ideally faster, yes.
Preferably.
There might be challenges or obstacles built into the course along the way. I think a lot of times those are the other contestants, just depending on the rules.
Yeah, no, totally dependent on the rules, right? So this is the stuff that varies from like an Olympic track where you've got, you know, 100 meters to a marathon run on foot, or, you know, NASCAR and Formula One where you're racing cars in a loop with these very strict engineering tolerances and limits and all types of, you know, fancy rules.
It might be like an off-road endurance race, like the Baja 1000, where there are spectators who are purposefully booby-trapping the course.
That's a true thing, by the way. There's like spectators of the Baja 1000 literally booby-trap the course against the competitors, and it's super dangerous.
Can they just stand on the sidelines and shoot at them?
I mean,
they
I suppose. Yeah. But they do things like they like build hole, like they just dig holes in the course, or they like build jumps unexpectedly. It's like super dangerous because the competitors have no idea that they're coming and they're technically against the rules. But like, you know, if you're going 60 miles an hour down like the back desert of Mexico and then suddenly hit a jump, it could be super bad.
So it sounds perfect for an RPG.
Yeah, it's exactly. you've also got things like The Amazing Race, right? Which is a TV show where teams of schmucks run around the world harassing locals for clues. And then they, from those clues, they figure out where they have to go next.
Hey, there's Cannonball Run, where instead of asking people questions to find clues, you just run them over.
Well, I guess they knew where they were going, right?
Yeah, you just had to do it as quickly as possible and not get caught.
Right. So mentioning Cannonball Run, I think there's a lot of like film adaptations of these that like have super iconic scenes, right? Like Ben-Hur has a 9-minute race that has its own series of urban legends about it.
There's the unfortunate pod race in Star Wars Episode 1.
Wait, you didn't like the pod race?
I mean, it's the best part of that terrible movie, but it is a very skippable movie. I adhere to machete order when it comes to Star Wars films.
Okay.
Which lops off Episode 1. There's nothing in it that's necessary.
But the pod race is still great, right?
The pod race is a good race.
Okay. Back when they were still movies about driving cars, the Fast and the Furious had a lot of races. Those are mostly like drag races in the street, right? But it's all about driving as fast as possible in a very short distance.
Yeah, and a race doesn't necessarily have to be run at the exact same time, right? People don't have to be on the track at the same time as you. Like, Cool Runnings is ultimately, like, it boils down to a race where it's timed. You're on that bobsled, and it's just you and the ice and the whatever the tube is called that they go down. I don't actually know anything about bobsledding, and I'm getting confused with luge, but
yep.
It's all great.
It's called a track.
Perfect.
They ride a sled.
A bobsled. It's in the song. And then there are tons of movies where people just race around in cars, right? Days of Thunder.
Yeah. If you prefer the IndyCar version, there's Driven. If you prefer the Formula One version, there's Rush. all the good episodes of Top Gear involve races in exotic places.
Yeah, ridiculous races.
Yeah.
With ridiculous cars, which are really what makes them.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so what are some key themes that are going to pop up when you are running or playing in a race?
So pure speed isn't everything. Like over a short distance, racing is about who's fastest, right? Like in a 100-meter sprint, you can't make up for speed. But the longer the distance of the race, or the longer the season, or the more heats you have to run, or the more races that are required to ultimately win, the less that pure speed is going to matter for you.
Yeah, like if there are black holes on the racetrack, which is quite possible, or there are rampaging dragons or griffins or what have you, then yeah, cornering is probably important.
Right. Or even if it's not, like, even if it is a less, you know, madcap kind of race, even if it is just like a 500 mile around an oval, right? Like the, over the course of the race, it's more about your focus and more about like how the team executes and the adjustments that you make during the race and like all of that sort of thing, right? It's less about just having a car that drives 181 miles an hour when everybody else drives 180.
Yeah. Being first doesn't always mean necessarily being fastest, although it helps.
Yeah, it does not hurt to just be faster.
Racing is also often about teamwork. Usain Bolt has a trainer. He also has an agent. He is a massage therapist. He has a bunch of fans. He has lucrative endorsement deals, which also help relieving stress in other parts of your life.
Yeah, I'm sure he's got a nutritionist and all types of people watching out to make sure that he continues to perform, you know, in tip-top shape.
And I think remembering this is one of the things that can make it a lot of fun to run a race scene, even if you end up with only sort of one person actually running the race, whether they're a sprinter or like one person driving a car. Like there was a mechanic who worked on that car.
Yep. So you've got things, you know, when you get to that, you have crew members, right? You could have multiple drivers even, you know, like you don't have one driver in the Baja 1000. You have a team because it's a long race. You could have support staff, like you said, you know, like even the guy negotiating your endorsement deals or doing your fan outreach helps you win the race in some small way.
Yeah. Or the decker who's hacking those traffic signals so that you get only greens and everyone else gets reds.
Oh, yeah. The decker who also invented Napster, I believe.
The decker who's actually driving the car.
And then the other major theme of racing is that rules are meant to be broken or at least stretched to their absolute limit. So whether that's through, you know, cheating like doping or, you know, using a slightly bigger engine or slightly more potent fuel, or it's just outright sabotage or booby traps or secret weapons or, you know, like spiky wheels to take out Ben-Hur's chariot, whatever it is, like that's all sort of in the spirit.
Whipping the other guy's horses.
Right.
Look, it's unsportsmanlike, but it's allowed.
Right. Like, technically it's illegal to shoot those racehorses full of painkillers if you get caught.
Yeah, and who's checking during the celebration afterward? Come on. They're doused in champagne.
Right.
You know, there's nothing in the rule book that says that a dog can't drive the car. It turns out he was born to the wheel.
Well, you know, they weigh the cars without the driver in them, so you can make weight and then have a much lighter driver if you're running it with a dog.
Oh, or a dog as a jockey. That's where it really counts. This little terrier.
I mean, that's already, you pretty much have to be dog-sized to be a jockey as a human.
Okay, but what if you had a dog who is the jockey of dogs?
Oh, like a miniature greyhound that rode on actual greyhounds?
Well, did greyhounds usually have jockeys?
No, I don't think they do. Also, I think greyhound racing is now illegal in every state, so...
That's a good thing.
That's gone.
Griffin racing, though, it's fine. It's fine. Griffins don't feel pain.
I mean, I'll take my griffin against your Pegasus any day.
That's because you're evil. All right, so how do you actually go about turning these iconic scenes into something that you can actually play in an RPG?
Yeah, so I think the challenge of doing this is that for the majority of RPGs that you play, racing isn't the core feature, right? So the mechanics are rarely covering all of the nitty-gritty that goes into, like, engineering and split-second reflexes and steely nerves and, like, all of those different things that sort of make those scenes dramatic without getting super repetitive very quickly. Because you really only have, like, your concentration check or your drive skill, you know? There's not really mechanics built around to enhance that.
Yeah. It's a 9-minute chariot race and I'm going to roll 1 percentile die, yeah?
Or it's a 9-minute chariot race and you're going to roll 10 percentile die. Is that more fun? It's the same roll.
Yes. Because everything gravitates toward the mean, I guess.
Sure.
So we should just look at our sheets and say who has the best odds, I guess.
100 rolls. 1,000 rolls.
Look, we're just going to do a chi-square. Right. With our dice.
So I think as a way of, you know, addressing that challenge, the goal then needs to be making your racing encounters feel like cinematic set pieces, right? Make them feel like a big deal in the session so that they're rewarding for all the different things that you have to do.
Yeah, and I think one of the ways that you can really do that is to play them a bit like they are cinematic set pieces. So you want to make sure that everyone has something to do, but you can cut between people doing those things. It's easier if you have some sort of instantaneous communication, you know, radio or the comm beads or something. But you can also shift between time periods, right? You can do the little mini flashbacks, like what did the mechanic do to the engine, or like how did they like add a nitro boost or something like that, depending on roles, right? And then in the moment of the race, you are finding out how well that worked, and then you can make the roll.
Yeah, so it's like as you hit that button, that red button on the dashboard, you find out, like, we flash back to the briefing before the race, right? Where the chief mechanic is like, okay, and this button, this deploys the grease field. Like, or this button, automatic 40 caliber turret.
Right, you have Q, like, explaining what's going on, but, like, whoever's playing Q can just make those rolls right then.
Right.
Yeah, like you don't need to make them ahead of time and then sort of write down how good it was.
And make them up as you go. And then keep in mind, like, there's just a lot of things that need to be done as a group of PCs to make sure that the race goes, right? So you've got driving, you have probably repairs, you might have offensive capabilities or defensive capabilities that need to be managed. You've got navigation or some type of broader strategy discussion. You might have, like, posturing in the pit.
Yeah, we talked about this a bit too in when we've talked about arena battles, but like, why is it that this race is being run? What is the purpose of it? Sure, you want to win, but what does that get the party? So other things will be happening, even if someone is not necessarily involved in the race itself. Maybe they're the one placing the bet or gambling or fixing the outcome or dealing with other drivers or like distracting other drivers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I like the idea of your social characters, right? Rather than being on the battle wagon running the death race, they're in the grandstands and like the watching the race with the nobles, right? And they're observing it and trying to make sure that like all the right people notice how well that battle wagon is running. And like, oh, do you know who's involved in that? And have you heard the name of the driver? And like, let me tell you about their sponsors and like the other nobles who are interested in backing them. And, you know, like kind of going through all of that stuff and reacting to what's going on the track or on the course as a way of like giving kind of broader context to the race.
Yeah, they should be the one on the box seats who is like egging on the bad guy to like lay down more stakes so that yep. they lose even more when you ultimately ideally win.
And of course, this is probably the role that doesn't have instant communication with the rest of the team. So you can use dramatic irony here too, right? Like whoever that they're posturing with or against might have some tricks up their sleeve that they're aware of that the rest of the team might not have any way of being warned about. So in terms of how you actually run this at the table, right? You want to always focus on the key moments of the action. You don't really need to talk about the 30 uneventful laps or the 30 uneventful miles that nothing happened and everyone just kind of had their foot on the pedal and managed to run a clean lap. That's not really that exciting.
Yeah, when ESPN cuts to commercial, so do you.
Right. We're here for the crashes, man.
Right.
But even like, you know, Cannonball Run doesn't put a spotlight on 400 miles of crossing Kansas, you know?
Yeah, at the most, it's like, I don't know, give me a check to see if you fall asleep.
Yeah, or, you know, like, on those, like, kind of road trip type things, they're just showing, like, a montage of the, welcome to Kansas, welcome to Colorado, welcome to Utah, right? And then it's like, oh, some action, we'll zoom in there.
Yeah, instead you want to focus in on the dramatic moments. And I guess in game terms, focus in on the moments where you're going to have people make rolls. You don't want them making rolls just to, like, maintain course and, like, you know, not fall far behind.
Yeah, the roll shouldn't just be extending the length of the encounter for no reason, right? Like, you don't need to make them earn the length of the race by adding extra rolls. You just want to focus on the pivotal moments of the race that affect the outcome.
Yeah, and I think this is what happens in a lot of modules or when people aren't really sure what to do when they are running a race. I think they just sort of say, all right, the race is, you know, 1,000 meters, and so I'll just force a roll every 100 meters, right?
Yep.
To see how fast you ran that.
Yeah, exactly. And you've fallen behind at the first checkpoint.
Yeah, and we'll just add those together, and right. We'll see what happens.
You're now in second place at the second checkpoint. That is not where the drama of this should come from.
No, they should come from the obstacles. Like if you hit a tricky bit of track, and people probably know where some of those tricky bits are coming, you know, the hairpin turn. But, you know, like you were saying, the Baja 1000, maybe you don't necessarily know. Like, oh, wow, surprise. There's a pit in front of you. Now you got to roll.
Yeah, so anytime that you've got like a case of sabotage or a booby trap.
Yeah, this is also even dramatic when it doesn't necessarily happen to your party, right? It could be that they're not in first, and so the people that they are behind are the ones who like encounter that pit first. So maybe they're not necessarily making a roll, or maybe they're making an easier roll to dodge out of the way when like the people in front of them obviously couldn't. But it's still dramatic that they can see what else is happening on the track.
Yeah, and keep in mind, like, you can have these beats that are just informative, right? Like, they could be clues as to what's gone on ahead of them. Like you said, if you're running significantly behind the front of the race, maybe you don't know what the first place team has in store on their, you know, what tricks they have up their sleeve. But if you see the burning wreckage of one car as you pass it, and then you see the, like, another one is flipped over on its roof, like, maybe you can start to piece together through clues, like, what are some of the things that the lead car is doing to its competitors?
Mm-hmm. It's like Mario Kart.
Actually, yeah, except there's a, you know, there's a fixed number of things the lead car can do to the competitors. And they all involve red shells.
on these races where you're going around a track multiple times, also, these can be recurring. You know, if you know there's an obstacle, or you know, like, your enemy has a sniper set up or some sort of explosion in an area near the finish line. All right. Well, after the end of lap one, you encounter it for the first time and it's terrifying. Now you know it's coming up near the end of lap two and three and four.
Yep.
How have they changed it in the meantime? Or how has the burning wreckage changed, right? If the dice end up that like two other cars explode in a fireball and you narrowly escape it, well, the next time you come around on the track, that's still going to be there. Like, mm-hmm. they sort of build on themselves.
Yeah, so anytime that you've got a chance to like directly conflict with one of the competitors, right? So whether that is just passing them, you know, like in a legit and clean race, or it's ramming them into the wall or boxing them out so they have to slow down, or using your spiked wheels on Ben Hur's chariot, whatever it is, like, you want to highlight those moments, right?
Yeah, and it's a nice opportunity to sprinkle in different types of roles, whether just straight up a skill role, or, you know, the player dealing with an obstacle on their own versus an opposed role where it's a head-to-head competition with the NPC.
Mm-hmm.
Or another player.
Right. I also like the idea of like catching up to a rival or catching up to a partner on the course, and like not to antagonize each other, but to like have a conversation, you know? Like the taunting or the jawing or the welcome back or let's do this, you know, like those kind of conversations also add a lot of like flavor and context to the race.
Yeah, like speed of plot is a thing, right? So, you know, if you do catch up, scenes in movies, you always are now neck and neck and the wind isn't too loud for you to have a conversation or to like insult each other. And then like somehow someone stomps, I guess, even harder on the gas pedal that they already had to the floor and then zooms ahead off right after their final quip.
That's the Ricky Bobby approach.
Yeah. It works in RPGs too.
No, that's actually mentioning that, like, that is very much how RPGs kind of play out if you turn them into a movie, right? Is it's very much like once Ricky Bobby and the other guy like hook up on the track, now they're an unbeatable duo, right? And they just keep their pedal to the metal and like then they go on and win the race.
Oh, the power of friendship.
I mean, until it's no longer friendship and it's rivalry and everything falls apart.
That's how parties work, Shane. Or podcasts.
Or podcasts. So throughout all this, I think it's important to maintain the tension. Make sure that players are staying in tune to the challenge that's coming and the stakes of the race, right? So you can do this narratively. Like, you know, as you're entering the final stretch, you know, the driver can see himself on the winner's podium holding a giant check for enough new yen to save your grandmother's company from the megacorps.
So let me ask you this. I think this is something that people often run into is if you are doing a series of checks on a race that is relatively long, if someone falls behind early on, it can begin to feel like there's absolutely no way to catch up, especially for those characters who are sort of like doing the math in their head.
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep people invested when I think there are certain kinds of players who are thinking, eh, now we're going to lose anyway. Like there's absolutely no way for us to catch up.
I mean, what's the cost of losing, right?
Death.
I mean, maybe not being last is enough of a victory, right? Like, I mean, that's why you have all the different players in different roles, right? Is you have various ways that you can communicate the importance of continuing to do as well as you can. And maybe it is because, like, you know, something bad will happen to you if you fail, or maybe it is like there's enough of a prize left over for, you know, the middle of the pack that it's still worth putting everything into.
Mm. I think it's also useful if you find yourself in that situation to quickly introduce to your party that many different things can go wrong. Like, mm-hmm. Great, if they felt like, oh man, we're so far behind, well, now is probably time for someone to die in a fiery explosion. Maybe someone who is near the lead, so right. That it becomes quite apparent that you never know what's going to happen. You may as well race as fast as you can.
Yep. There's also sort of the a trope in racing films of like the noble benefactor, right? Who sort of like sees a team struggling, but sees that spark of they could be more. And that's enough of an inspiration for them to like want to get invested in the team.
You know, those ducks have gumption.
Yeah, exactly.
They're definitely going to lose, but they're losing really well.
Right. And if they just had my resources and money and connections, like maybe they could be winners. And wouldn't it be great?
Yeah, that works really nicely if you have more than one race in your campaign. Yeah. Like if it's a consistent thing, you can lose the first few and that's fine.
Mm-hmm. So on that note, right, the race should be a backdrop for further drama and further plot hooks. So in a self-contained sense, like you could be asking the question, can all of the PCs kind of keep it together in this high-pressure racing environment, right? Like, if one player is becoming despondent because they're falling behind, how is their character behaving? And does the rest of the team need to rally that character in order to, like, continue performing so that they have a chance?
Or, while all the spectators are watching the race, what is the true goal of the PCs? Are they off actually stealing something and all of this was just an elaborate distraction?
I mean, yes.
definitely. We still wanted to win the race because there's prize money.
This is a D&D race, right?
Was it a coincidence that the race was right by the bank?
And then, of course, there's the drama around the outcome, right? So victory could bring you fame or notoriety or rivalry. Failure could bring you shame or, you know, angry sponsors, or, like we said earlier, potentially like a new avenue or a new kind of benefactor.
Yeah, always think, what is the purpose of winning the race? Like, in real life, you know, you've won. That's great. But, you know, in the game, if you're likely adventurers, then you have some other ulterior motive. Or, like, there's a reason you got wrapped up in this, and you're probably not spending, like, your entire adventuring career just running races.
Mm-hmm. So, real quick, let's talk about the types of races you might structure in your session or in your campaign.
Probably the simplest one is just a single encounter. It's impromptu or, you know, just pops up in the game. Something like Fast and the Furious drag race right on the street.
Yeah, so there's, if you remember the very first Fast and the Furious, which I know came out like 30 years ago.
Yeah, I was already in my 60s, so
right.
I wasn't watching those kinds of movies.
So there's the nerdy dude who's part of their group who races the rich Japanese guy. And they race for pink slips. And if you recall, it's like a very short scene. They run the race. It turns out that his opponent has, you know, like $100,000 under the hood. And he just smokes the guy. And so he's going to lose his car. So he just drives off into the sunset. Right? Like, to me, if that were a scene in an RPG, that would be one skill roll. And he failed his driving check. And the opponent won. And that's it. Right? Like, all that happened there was like a yes, no, like, do you win? And the drama is in that outcome. Right?
Right. It didn't matter. Not even like a 4E skill challenge.
Right. No, no, no. Just like one check.
If you had one check, one opportunity,
would you let it all pink slip?
Pink slip away.
Something, something, mom's spaghetti.
It's the prize. It's the prize.
Whereas, like, if you think of all the races that involve Paul Walker, right, those are more like skill challenges, right? They have multiple skill checks kind of round after round. Like, they've got traffic to dodge in and out of. They've got to, like, time the correct usage of their nitrous or whatever they have to do, right? They've got that iron will to, like, stare each other down as they're, I don't know. It's hard to describe Fast and the Furious seriously. But anyway, like, that's kind of a series of skill checks, right? Or a skill challenge that kind of puts you over that limit.
And the key here is that it's fast, it's quick. It may not even involve everybody at the table because it probably only takes a few minutes max.
Right. Then the next step up from that is more of an extended encounter. That's where you've got multiple rounds, you're using various skills, everybody in the group is participating. That's sort of like, this is our big combat for the session, right? Like, this is our big encounter. This is what we're going to spend an hour on today.
Yeah, everybody has to be involved. It's quite possible that, like, the players already know that it's coming up and they've already been prepping for it for a while.
Yeah, this is where you probably want to use, like, a combat style initiative system so that everybody is taking equal turns. You might play with the length of time in a round rather than locking it into, like, you know, one roll per lap. You might just kind of play with it a little bit and leave it a little more narrative.
Yeah, at the dinner party overlooking the race from the spaceport, you probably only quip once something actually happens, right?
Yeah, I mean, otherwise you're just eating your salad.
Yeah. Daintily.
That would be a fun way to measure progress in a race.
How far are you into your salad?
Yeah, oh, we're on to the soup.
Right, it's the fourth course already.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God, we haven't even talked about eating contests.
All right, and then I think the longest form of the racing encounter is when you make it a recurring thing or like a set of encounters, something like a season or a circuit, where you've got kind of like incremental progress towards your ultimate goal gained from each running of the race or each heat or whatever.
Yeah, this ends up playing out a lot more like a typical adventure archetype. Where, you know, you're seeding hints at it early, and then there's preparation, and then everyone knows it's coming, and then you're playing it out, and then you learn from those mistakes, and then as they, you know, come back around, or you can decide how to tackle it next time, you get better at it, ideally.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you run this, you want, you know, over time, you want to kind of distill down a race into its few moments that matter, right? Like, you might start out with kind of a full encounter for your first race as the players are kind of learning how this works. But as you get towards the end of the season, you might roll one skill check to see how you did in that race. Or you might have a montage where you've got like a few scenes interspersed in between to deal with like, oh, you won this race and like, what does that mean? And you lost this race and what does that mean?
Yeah. It can also go the other way around where the earlier races are the ones that are simpler and you don't necessarily play them out like to the hilt. So the first race might just be, all right, how quickly do you get off the line? Because this is a drag race, right? And so now we have played out that mechanic of like waiting for the lights to shift to green and then you jumping off the start line. Great. And then in another race, you might sort of slowly introduce the idea of obstacles or like people in the stands or like different mechanical issues. And then in the final one, you know, where it's the end of the arc, we have the big race, we play out the entire thing for like an hour and a half and all of those things come into play and everybody knows how those mechanics work. So they can even like sort of jump in and be like, oh, wait, maybe I'm the mechanic and I did this thing, you know, when it was still back in the shop. Like, would that work and can I roll that?
Yeah. And narratively, like, you structure this as like, cool, so you're a brand new racer. Like, you have to start in like the most junior circuits, right? Like, we start racing speeder bikes and then we race speeders and then we race like, you know, X-Wings. And now we race like, I don't know, Star Destroyers. The scale got real weird.
Entire planets.
But you have to prove yourself, right? Like, you have to work your way up to being in the top circuit, in the top flight.
Right. Welcome to the Death Star Rally.
Yeah. Also, at no point did I mention pod racing in my series of circuits.
You know, I've got a Death Star 1. It's an old junker, but I had to put it back together from bits I found floating around Endor.
It's got very strong offensive capabilities, though.
Sorry, Yavin. First one was Yavin 4.
Oh,
sorry.
You're right. It was. Embarrassing. Yeah, and I think the kind of typical arc for these, you know, and you can play with this however you want to, but if you do that sort of that first race where they see the full detail of it and kind of work through all the challenges in the race, then you kind of montage to something more mid-season where either there's a major setback or a major boost that kind of propels them forward. And then you accelerate really quickly into this sort of dramatic finale, right, in which they're, again, kind of focused on the nitty-gritty because, you know, the last race always takes 20 minutes of the hour and a half movie. The first race always takes 20 minutes. And what happens in between is sort of all the drama that goes around it.
I also think mechanically, a race is a good opportunity to sort of like dive into very specific mechanics rather than necessarily just asking for a skill roll each time. You can have limited abilities that make sense in why they're limited. Like, you have a particular number of nitrous charges and that's how many you get to use, right? And you have a particular number of like whatever oil slicks you can drop or like flash bangs that you can throw out the window or whatever, right? On a vehicle, which is usually where these races are happening, or, you know, on the race, you don't have access to all of your resources. You've had to leave things behind, you've had to bring things with you. It can be a nice little like resource management game where like whoever is racing has like this is what you have to work with, and like that you're gonna have to hoard those till the end, or like, you know, you're gonna have to use this in order to get out of the scrape or whatever it is that people are throwing at you, and then aside from that, you're kind of on your own.
Yeah for sure. So Ishan, what's the best racing encounter you've ever had at your table?
Oh, boy. So relatively recently, I played in the dinosaur races in Tomb of Annihilation. So not too many spoilers, but like people can ride on the backs of dinosaurs, and the dinosaurs sort of all have like different kinds of stats, the same way that like different cars might have stats, and whoever rides on them makes different kinds of checks. And I didn't ride on the dinosaur. I had a great time by standing on the sidelines and sending my familiar along with our racer and casting spells through my familiar to, I guess, kind of sort of cheat.
Kind of, sort of.
I mean, there was nothing in the rules that says you couldn't do that.
So it's just frowned upon, is what you're saying.
I don't know. It's Schultz, and like, I didn't speak the language.
Right.
So I just assumed. And, you know, there's only 100 foot range, so I did have to keep up with the dinosaurs.
So you had to get on the infield, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly, right? As they're going around, you're like, okay, well, now I got to triangulate. Yeah. It was good. I also learned, well, I didn't learn, I realized that we really need to pay attention to who's betting on whom, because we had two people running and only one of them can win.
And you didn't balance your bets.
That's exactly right. Yeah, because, you know, two people are like, oh, I want to run a dinosaur race. Oh, yeah, me too. Great. Okay. Hey, I'm going to put a bunch of money on you because we're in the same party. And it just, yeah, it didn't work out. So we won and still lost. All right. What about you?
So it feels like I would be cheating if I mentioned Reckoness Racing, right?
Yeah, but, you know, that seems like the kind of thing you would do.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole game built around racing. So, I mean, I had a good session of that. And, I like that game a lot. I think I would rather say the best racing encounter I've never had, which was we actually had a death race potentially, like, planned for Rogue Trader in Meridian. But you guys took it a different direction.
Oh, instead they did the...
The Battle Royale, yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Is a spoiler.
Hey, that's coming.
Yeah, instead of a death race, like, it ended up being that. Just because that's, like, I had tried to drop a few hints a couple times and, like, you know, like, mentioned they were, like, tooling on their auto carriages and different things, and, like, no one ever got curious as to why, so I was like, cool, we're not doing a race then.
Maybe they thought an auto carriage was a gun.
No, because I feel like I had described, yeah. I don't think that's the case. I just think it just wasn't compelling.
Battle Royale sounded more interesting to them.
Well, you didn't have a choice in the Battle Royale. Like, I had to do something.
Well, I think that's sort of one of the points, is that races are often not done well. And so, like, I think people envision that, like, it won't necessarily be all that much fun, when, like, it can be if, mm-hmm. you know, you do it properly.
Yeah.
A couple race scenarios that I want to run that I haven't yet, but I have in mind. Eberron has this thing called the Race of the Four Winds, which I think is run canonically, like, once every year in Sharn. And it's like you ride griffins or have chariots that are pulled by flying creatures, and you, like, race around the towers of Sharn, like, 1,000 feet above the ground.
Oh.
And, you know, other people are trying to stop you and knock you out of the way. And, like, you're, you know, flying through, like, flying around, like, magical skyscrapers, and, like, people live here, and there are, like, bridges that are connecting these towers. So, like, tons of obstacles, and, like, people just living their lives who are like, ah, why are you, you know, you're basically like running through the fruit cart, except that the fruit cart is like a sky sled that's, you know, 800 feet over, like, a crowd.
Nice.
Which is something I want to do. And then also I'd love to somehow adapt the French card game Mealborn into an RPG. Maybe use that as the resources, like the different obstacles that you can throw in the way of enemies, and the different remedies that you can use to fix the obstacles that you run into.
Do you want to stop the podcast and just go play Mealborn instead?
Oh my god, that sounds amazing. Kind of, yeah. Hey, one more thing you could do if you're running a race, just stop the game, play Mealborn, and you've got it.
All right, do you hear that, Ishan?
Coup ferré.
I don't know what that means.
You need to play more Mealborn.
Guess it's time to move on to the character creation forge and roll a character who speaks French. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
Oh man, I really want to experience the magic of Dungeons and Dragons, but I'm a cave hermit who made an oath never to speak to other people again.
And I want to watch a classic fantasy series like Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones, but I can't stand the sight of human faces. Well, I want to relive the magic of make-believe, the humor of a preschool-age child, and the genuine camaraderie of nearly 10 years of friendship through only my ears, but I don't know how!
You ignorant fools! You don't even know about Dames and Dragons!
What? But Dames and Dragons? What's that?
Dames and Dragons is a Dungeons and Dragons actual play podcast.
A podcast? So I can experience the spontaneous group storytelling of D&D without breaking my oath of solitude?
That's right.
And I can take part in a rich fantasy storyline without ever having to lay eyes on a disgusting human face?
Never again will the faces plague you.
And it has a cast of 4 female friends who make constant immature jokes as they play?
Absolutely. I would never lead you astray, my friend. Whether you love D&D or just love a good fantasy tale, Dames and Dragons is the podcast for you. Tells the story of 3 unlikely heroes who are chosen to become guardians of the goddess of their world, a floating island by the name of Estra.
By God, that sounds like something I could get into.
Sounds like something I'd love.
Sounds like something I'd make.
Well, that's just ridiculous. Dames and Dragons, updated every second Monday, wherever podcasts are sold.
All right, so this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building the Marathoner, who I guess is actually one guy.
Yeah, that one guy, the first Marathoner, right? Tell us about him, because, I don't know, was he just into self-punishment?
No. His name was Philippides, and he was basically a courier. Like, he wasn't really even a soldier. But so what happens is, you know, sometime ancient Greece, the Persians land at Marathon. And so when this happens, he runs 150 miles in 2 days to enlist the help of the Spartans to fight the Persians. So then, separately, he runs 25 miles from Athens to Marathon and then 25 miles back to Athens to announce that the Persians have been defeated, at which time he dies.
See, this is why no one should run marathons. Also, wait, I thought it was 26.2 miles. Why is it 25 miles?
It's 25 miles because that's the actual distance. And I don't know. I actually looked this up on Google Maps, and it's like 40 kilometers and change.
Is it because people didn't really have Google Maps and satellites, and they measured it as 26.2 miles? Okay.
So I don't know the history of the original marathon. I didn't look that up.
That's because we don't do research on this show.
Exactly. All I did was look up Philippides' name.
Okay, so we are going to build a character who runs and dies.
We're going to try not to die.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So in order to not die, we're going to take advantage of the overland travel rules. So the way this works, basically, is you can move at a fast pace, and you take a -5 penalty to perception while you are doing that. And with a normal 30-foot movement speed, that allows you to move 30 miles per day. It's math, but it basically amounts to you move, like, your feet in miles per hour times 8 is your movement in a day.
So the goal here is to run from Athens to Marathon and back in a day without dying?
Yeah, so I took... No. I did this in the 2-day trip of 150 miles to Sparta.
Ah, I see. So we need to run 75 miles a day for 2 days consecutively without dying.
Exactly.
Well, that's a lot of miles.
Yeah, and so a fast pace basically gives you an extra 10 feet of movement, so it treats you as having 40 instead of 30. So in order to get that, we will need to get to 50 feet of base movement. We will need to address our -5 wisdom or our -5 perception penalty. And we're going to need good con saves to make our exhaustion checks. Because for every hour you run past 8 hours, you make an increasing DC con save.
Right, because you are now forced marching.
Exactly.
All right, so what is the build?
The build is Scout Rogue 11, Monk 2, Champion Fighter 7.
So also one thing that I like about this is we've sort of we haven't ignored the rogue's cunning action, but I think that something to consider when you're running longer races in 5th edition D&D is that if you sort of look at just how far can a character travel, a rogue can dash as a bonus action at will, which just makes them so much faster than anybody else. But I think like in a real actual race where there's distance to cover or like all day, I would have it be that you can use cunning action for some of the other abilities. You can, or you can like manipulate an object, or you can stop down, you can like pick something up, or you know, do something without slowing down. But I probably wouldn't let you use it to dash all day, because that screws with the overland travel rules.
Yeah, and like cunning action is meant to be like sort of a bullet time activity, not like an extended like just double your sprint speed forever activity.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, if you are like racing a few hundred feet to like save a dying companion, like that's what it's used for.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so I would draw the line at 1600 meters, sir.
Well, yes, every Olympic athlete is a rogue.
Right. So we will, of course, start as a wood elf. That gives you 35 base movement. There are two ways to cheat. One is to be a centaur, which has 40 feet of movement base, but is, of course, half horse, which is therefore not Philippides.
Hey, and, hey, that is their word. You can't just call people half horse.
And also the Aarakocra, which has a 50-foot fly speed, which would be flying this distance and therefore not running this distance, which is in clear violation of the spirit.
Also, any kind of druid using wild shape or wizards using polymorph.
Right. Yeah. Also, no magic. That's important here.
Oh, we're not even using Longstrider. That's true. Philippides had no magic.
Right. So, with this build, we should be able to get to 18 constitution, 20 dex, and 14 wisdom, because we have 4 ASIs, and the wood elf gets a small bonus to dex. We will get to a 55-foot base speed, and at fast pace, that will be 52 miles per day, an extra 6.5 miles per hour of forced march. That means we'll need 12 hours to make it to Sparta. That'll require 4 con saves at DC 11, 12, 13, and 14, which we will make at a plus 10, thank God.
We got a base perception of 14. We'll still have a plus 9, so a passive perception of 19 while moving at a fast pace. Fortunately, the Spartans have already been defeated when we were making this run.
Yeah. Though perhaps we could have been ambushed on our way to Sparta.
Very true. From Monk 2, you get unarmed movement. That's an additional 10 feet without armor. Of course, you will not be wearing armor while you are running this marathon.
No, that would be foolish.
You get key and unarmed strikes, which are fine, but they're not. You're not particularly good with them.
No, this is just a cheap 10 feet of movement. I don't know. You could have taken the mobility feat, I suppose. Doesn't mobility give you extra movement?
Plus 10 feet, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I wanted the ASIs for stats instead of feats.
Also, you're not going to be carrying weapons with you. They're too heavy. You want to be able to punch people.
Right. Then from Champion Fighter 7, we will get the all-important proficiency in constitution saving throws. We'll also take archery fighting style. You'll get your action surge, your second wind, your extra attack, all the usual fighter stuff. But as a champion, you'll get improved critical. That's nice to have. What we're really here for, though, at level 7 is remarkable athlete. Normally, this lets you add half proficiency to strength, con, and dex checks if you're not proficient. That's all well and good. It also doubles your running jump speed. That's all well and good. I think what's most important here is you want to be called a remarkable athlete.
Oh, yes. What is the terrain like between Athens and Marathon?
I assume it's rolling hills, because isn't that most of Greece? I guess it could be a plain, though.
It's probably not cliffs.
No.
Because it's...
That would be climbing a marathon, not running one.
I'm very surprised he was able to make that run. All right, from Rogue 11, 66 sneak attack. Skirmisher lets us move half our speed as a reaction if an enemy ends adjacent to us, which is nice if we are about to get ambushed. And Survivalist gives us expertise in both nature and survival.
Of course, as a rogue, you'll get 4 expertises, 4 additional ones. You'll use one of those for perception, and I suppose it's fair to use one for athletics as well, but...
just in case you need to climb.
Right.
Scramble over rocks.
You'll get the usual rogue tanky abilities, uncanny dodge, and evasion. And then what we're here for is superior mobility at level 9. That's an extra 10 feet of base movement. That's how you get to 55 feet.
Plus, reliable talent means you're never going to roll low on perception, nature, survival, and, you know, athletics, right? You'll always be a good climber even though your strength is low.
Right. So in terms of leveling order, I think I would... Well, you have to start fighter. That's the only hard and fast rule because you need that constitution saving throw proficiency. But after that, I would probably take fighter to 3, then monk 2, get my rogue all the way to 11, and then fighter 7. So, Ishan, who is your marathoner?
My marathoner is a brave coward. In that, she always kites.
Okay.
She is uninterested in close-up combat because she knows how dangerous it is. She's very smart about this. Instead, she takes her bow, which she's very good at, runs as far away as she possibly can, and plinks away at the enemy. When they finally close the distance, she runs away again. They may even think, you know what? Ha, she's turned tail. She's given up. Like, look at her. She's what, 10 miles away? Nope, she's just waiting for you to catch up so she can shoot you in the face again.
Okay.
And of course, she's a scout. She can live out in the wilderness for as long as she needs to, and often does, because, well, you know, other people are a little bit terrifying. She's a little timid, but she isn't actually really a coward, because of course she's not actually running away. She's just taking a more advantageous position. It's always a tactical retreat. Shane, what about your marathoner?
So my marathoner is a noble. Grew up with plenty of wealth, not a whole lot of challenges, you know, never really had to fight or worry about those types of things. But, you know, as a hobby, takes up archery, you know, for like hunting and those types of, you know, activities of the well-appointed. Trains excessively, you know, like the kind of person who just like trains for the sake of training, right? So they can just tell their friends that, oh yeah, you know, I ran 26.2 miles today, and you know, maybe even like has like a little button that they wear on their cloak that, you know, denotes 26.2. You know, like really foppish, you know, really likes to eat kale and all of those, like, you know, is always on the latest of the dining trends for superfoods and all of that stuff, you know, like supply of good berry for days, you know.
Does your wood elf have a giant beard?
No, of course not, but it's very slight of build.
Right, that beard would not be aerodynamic.
Right. You know, is always like even my marathoner's cloak is, you know, very tightly tailored so it has less wind resistance. You know, my marathoner's just passing through.
Wonderful.
And then, you know, next month we'll travel to another city to run a marathon there, I guess,
if you qualify. Yeah. Yeah. Just hoping.
Well, that's the thing is, you know, like you got to run the marathon in the Carnathy half in order to qualify for the Sharn marathon.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah. You got to work your way up.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to earn it.
Yeah. And that's what I'm here for.
You know, and in the off season, sometimes they'll do those marathons that involve the obstacles. I think it's rough mud, right? It's where that remarkable athlete, reliable talent in athletics really comes in handy.
I hate this.
Good con saves means you can hold your breath.
Right.
While you're getting electrocuted, I guess.
All right. Before we wrap up, let's take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
All right, so what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We are talking about playing the Drow.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building Drizzt Do'Urden.
Wait, I didn't sign off on this.
Yeah, I know. I made an executive decision, and you are trapped.
It's a problem with a 50-50 partnership. Well, that's it for episode 189 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
Total Party Thrill is brought to you this week by Elderwood Academy. Elderwood Academy are artisans who craft amazing gaming products, including dice towers, dice trays, dice boxes, deck boxes, dice, and more.
All of the products are crafted to look like spellbooks, roll cases, codices, and other awesome fantasy gear that we love, including the dice keychain, which is a tiny little fob that you add to your keys that keeps dice inside, which means you're never without dice.
Yeah, the Hex Chest Mini is what they call it on their site. It has room for 7 polyhedral mini dice and foam to keep them quiet so you're not rattling around in your pockets.
Right, so you're not that person at work.
So, like, yeah, it's for when you want to keep your nerd stuff close at hand, but you don't want anybody to know that you're doing it.
Yeah, like when I keep my kunai quietly in my bag and I don't take it out and then put on my Leaf Village headband at work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly like that.
I just do it in the bathroom quietly, alone.
Okay.
where I can feel the will of fire fill me.
Ishan. I don't have time to go into this in the middle of this Elderwood Academy ad, which the good folks at Elderwood Academy have paid us to do. So why don't you tell listeners where they could get the mini Hex Chest dice boxes so that perhaps they'll support Elderwood Academy, they'll give us more money, and you can get help.
They should support Elderwood Academy because, Shane, how often does someone show up to our game and go, oh yeah, I forgot my dice. Oops, forgot my dice.
2 people did it last week and 1 person did it the week before.
Yes, so if everyone had these, that would never happen, and you can get your very own at elderwoodacademy.com/don't split.